And it's me, Anna D, Anna DeVlantis, high above Columbus and Wacker Drive here in the Skyline Studios on WGN. So why is it, I wonder, why is it that we can feel so close, so personally connected when a celebrity dies, especially in a case of a sudden tragic death like Kobe's? It's something I've been thinking about today, and you can feel so deeply personal. You know, even though really that person is a total stranger, you don't know them, you have shared experiences of watching them, seeing them perform on the court, be a celebrity off the court. And, you know, very few of us really knew Kobe Bryant. We are going to talk to Ryan Baker from CBS2 coming up. He did have moments of, certainly covered him over the years, but also had certain exchanges with him, some personal time with him. And he's going to talk about that. But I was in the Verizon store yesterday when I got the news. And just the fact that I even know that, I think, says something, right? You know where you kind of were yesterday when you heard about it. So that's true. But then, you know, I overheard there was another guy in the store waiting as I was, you know, to get service, working on our phones and stuff. And he took a call. I later learned it was from his son. And the call was, you know, hey, I know it's so sad. I mean, and he looked as if it was someone he knew, that someone very close to him. And then when he got off the phone, we talked a little bit, and he said, yeah, my son and I, we've watched the NBA together a lot. And we've, you know, it's just been part of our lives. And man, I can't believe it. It's just stunning. It really is. And so we talked after, and he's just like, you know, it just felt like he was in this state of shock. Right.
It's a unique aspect of celebrity, but in a way, even though they don't know you, you feel as though you know them because you've seen interviews with them. So you feel as though you know things about the celebrity besides what they do. You've followed their career throughout the years. Mm-hmm. You've been able to mark milestones in your life based on where you were, for example, with Kobe when he won the championship, perhaps, you know, so it's even though
they're shared moments,
right?
Even though you weren't really there with them,
right?
You still feel it. I mean, look, I cannot imagine what it's like for his wife, for his family. She has lost a husband. She's mm-hmm. lost a child. Her daughters have all lost a sister and a daddy, and that is the kind of grief that falls in a completely different category.
I also think about the other victims in the helicopter crash.
Absolutely.
And how not that anyone is more important than any life is more important than any other life, but when it's being reported in the news, of course Kobe is the person that people know, so then it's you know, he's passed and his daughter's passed, and then the other victims really don't get mentioned by name.
Right. We're going to talk about some of them, too, because you're right. There were also people involved with basketball, some of her teammates.
Yeah.
Other young lives.
Right.
And their
and
parents.
And I think about those families and how they must be reacting to the coverage as well.
Right. Thinking that's this wreckage for my family as well.
Right.
And just that kind of taking that in. Well, coming up on the show, we are going to talk with a psychologist who has studied this issue and explains why these tragic passings of celebrities can sometimes feel so close to us. And also the effort to make donations and focus on girls basketball in the wake of that is, as you point out, several young lives were lost there. Nine total.
Mm-hmm.
But other young basketball players, coaches, people involved in girls basketball.
And there was one that was a family, a father who was the baseball coach, his wife, and mm-hmm. then their daughter.
That's right.
So it was a whole family there.
And Gianna Bryant and her teammates, the two other girls who she knew who were on that helicopter, she was a standout athlete herself, and everyone knew Kobe as Coach Kobe in their world because they wanted to play in the WNBA one day, these girls.
I think it's
had a real shot at it, too.
I think it's really insightful that you're having this psychologist on because I think the grief, even though you don't know the celebrity, is very real. It's a very legitimate grief.
I'm telling you, to see this guy in the phone store, and I did not know all of the news at that moment, it just struck me. And then later I thought, gosh, all of us might have felt that way, especially if you followed the NBA in any way or felt close to him by following his career. I mean, he was a baby when he first came in. What is he, 17? And he grew up before our eyes.
And I think about when Princess Diana died, I remember where I was. I remember thinking about John F. Kennedy Jr. I remember where I was. I remember thinking about Prince.
you know
where you were.
Everyone. You do. And so we'll talk about that. We'll talk to Ryan Baker. He has some thoughts about it and how Chicago is reacting. Chicago sports teams and people in Chicago who knew him, including Chicagoans like Michael Jordan, D. Wade, their response to it. You saw LeBron James on the tarmac just bawling, crying. when he got the news. There's some more about Tiger Woods having a similar reaction. He was loved, and that's for sure. Not a man who's infallible in any way, and he certainly never said he was, but that there's that piece of the history as well. And in trending topics, we'll get to some of that. In addition to the Grammys, a former coworker of ours, Domiti Pongo, he was here at WGN Radio for like a minute, and we knew he'd just like go on to great things. Well, he's at MTV News now. He was on the red carpet. He was interviewing all of the big stars, Billie Eilish, every single one of them. It felt like I was watching him go. I talked to him today, and he's like, I have so much to say. It was such a cool night. So he's going to check in with us from L.A. as well. So that's pretty cool. Then, plus, Alderman Wagasback is here. He's the city finance chair. Number of questions about city finances. There always are, right? We're not always in great shape there. But some promising news has come to light. He'll share that with us. Also, he's the guy that wants to stop the plastics in the restaurants. So remember the straws, the plastic utensils. He's giving restaurants a year now to say, hey, we're really going to seriously reduce this. You're going to have to ask for the plastic utensils. You're going to have to ask for the straw. That's how things are changing. And then a couple of pieces of news today out of the city as well that we're going to ask him about, including that Opportunity Zone story.
I do love contributing to not creating more waste in small ways, like a straw, but then the cardboard straw, after you're using it a while, it sure does disintegrate and make it.
No one is a fan of the paper straw. Please text us, call us, 312-981-7200, if you actually like the paper straw. They disintegrate in your mouth.
They do. They really do. And I, but there have been better ones. I've noticed there's bamboo straws, which mm-hmm. work and stay a little more stable. And the plastics made from plants as well that I've noticed that are supposedly, decompose quickly. I don't mm-hmm. know.
And bamboo is more sustainable, and I get it, but the paper gets all mushy
it
in your
really
mouth,
does.
And it starts to interfere with your margarita. I've learned that has happened to me on an occasion. So we'll talk with him about that. But he's got some other plans too about recycling. Why we're not doing so well at that in Chicago? That's not going great, and there's a new plan to make it go better. If you've had people visit you from other cities, and they come in and they say, where's your recycling? Or what do you, mm-hmm. how do you breaking things down? And California goes nuts. They have like five different bins. You know, you have to go on the bottom and look at the number, and then you put it in mm-hmm. the proper bin for that
That's
number.
That's why so many people think that it's not really being recycled, because my friends will say, gee, you just throw it all in the same container? And I say, yes. And they said,
How does that work?
Who sorts it? And then, you know, a used pizza box ruins the whole thing. Apparently, if you throw a pizza box in a recycling bin, then the entire bin gets thrown out.
There was a story about that, how they can call the whole bin contaminated.
Call the whole thing off, Anna.
Right? Just the whole thing is not okay because of one piece or more morsel of food that gets into the containers that are supposed to be washed or cleaned, or those cans are supposed to be rinsed out. And if they're not, contaminated. What's up with all of that? So hopefully Alderman Scott Wagasback can answer all these questions. I'm not sure he's armed to speak to all of those things, but I'll tackle him anyway. We'll see what he has to say. Coming up here on WGN Radio. We're here on WGN Radio right now. This is Anna DeVlantis, and we're checking in with my friend Ryan Baker, longtime sports anchor here in Chicago. Just made the switch over to the morning news chair at CBS2, but you covered the NBA for a long time. And I know you had some personal interactions with Kobe. You had to be shaken up by this news. And I almost felt like, Ryan, even though you're a consummate professional, I almost felt like I could see that on your face this morning as you were doing the news.
Well, first of all, thanks for having me, Anna. It's so great to be back with you again, because people might forget when we did the weekend shows together
and
at Channel 5 when I came back to Chicago. Can you believe it's 17 years now?
No, I can't.
03.
I mean, cannot.
And we did the shows together. We covered the Olympics together.
We were in Greece together. That was a fun time.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it was. But of course, you know, it's nice to reflect on those happy times on a day like today, because, sure. I mean, it is very difficult. It's hard. I mean, we're supposed to be objective and removed as journalists, but I'm also a basketball fan. And
I know you are.
I'm a fan of the NBA. I covered Kobe when he came into the league in 1996 as this teenage kid that nobody really knew about. And the first time I saw him, I said, okay, I get it. This kid, he's not there yet, but he's going to be a star. And I've had the good fortune over the last 20, 25 years to be in some personal situations with Kobe through mutual friends. Some when I worked in Orlando covering the Magic, when Shaq was there, and obviously I have a relationship with Shaq going back many years, and just different situations that I've been able to actually visit with him and talk to him and get to know him a little bit. I mean, we're not close friends by any stretch, but what always struck me about Kobe is how genuine he was, because he would see me at another game, another event, and he'd make eye contact, hey, how you doing? And it just, you know, and I posted a couple pictures on social media, and those are two things that, you know, a couple of instances that stand out. But man, this hurts. I mean, not just that Kobe Bryant is gone at the age of 41, but how it happened, losing his daughter, the seven other victims, and a horrific helicopter crash. I mean, it's just absolutely gut-wrenching.
It is, and you look at a number of celebrities, other fellow NBA stars like Scottie Pippen, D. Wade, who seem devastated by this news. They knew Kobe well and are weighing in on this. D. Wade saying, this is one of the saddest days of my lifetime. It seems like a bad dream that I just want to wake up from. You saw Michael Jordan say, he was like a little brother to me. So many others weigh in. And then Zach LaVine, the Bulls guard, you know, young player, said, more than basketball, man, he has four daughters.
That's right.
Life is crazy.
That's right.
And this is somebody who said he kind of grew up watching him. He said, you know, he had this mindset that was bigger than basketball. Unbelievable loss. You were one of my biggest influences. You forget about that. He not only was coaching young girls to be great basketball players, and that was sort of phase two for Kobe, Coach Kobe, but then you think about all the young players coming up in the league who were impacted by him.
Well, and that's it. And that's the bulk of the young players. I mean, first of all, the NBA is much younger than it was. I hate to sound like an old fogey, but in our day or in generations past, because the players are younger, and they did grow up idolizing Kobe just as much as they would want to wear Air Jordans, they'd wear Kobe's shoes. And, I mean, Kobe is a dynamic force, arguably one of the top five players to ever play the game, bar none, period. So, I mean, he's revered and respected so highly amongst his peers, amongst fans, not just in Los Angeles or the country, but around the world. I mean, this is a guy, you know, with his history of being raised partly in Italy when his father played professionally over there and spoke Italian and had other thoughts and interests outside of basketball. I mean, the guy won an Oscar. what other retired Hall of Fame player, you say, won an Oscar like a year or two after they walk away from the game because he wanted to create, he wanted to tell stories and become, make films. And,
right.
And he was doing all of that. And as he called it, a second act, and everyone was confident he was going to be as good or better in this second chapter of his life that he was as a player. And let's not forget, I mean, he survived a huge scandal as a player. If you go back to 03 with the rape allegations in Colorado, which he denied, he did admit that he had an extramarital affair. He took it head on. But he when I think of Kobe, just one word comes to mind. It's just the ultimate competitor.
Mm-hmm. And you know,
I mean, and he was right there in that Michael Jordan level.
He talked about how, you know, with his daughter told him, with that Oscar you mentioned, he's like, they tell me, you're telling us to shoot for our dreams and to, like, keep setting goals for ourselves. Where's your goal? So then he goes off and he wins the Oscar. And I thought,
how about that?
He's winning an Oscar? How is that possible? I mean, my gosh. The other victims, let's talk about them, because that ties us,
sure,
Ryan Baker, to this other conversation about girls basketball. Gianna's 13-year-old basketball teammates, Peyton Chester, Alisa Altobelli among the dead. Chester's mother, Sarah, also killed, along with Altobelli's parents, longtime college baseball coach John Altobelli, and his wife Carrie. Those are the other victims, all of them really involved in girls basketball, and some really talented players there with huge hopes and dreams for the future.
I mean, you're a mom. I have two young daughters. I mean, you just think that more than anything in this world, I think I could speak for any parent, we want to protect our children, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you don't want anything to happen to them, any kind of harm. And I just can't fathom the moments before that helicopter crashed, that for all of the victims in that helicopter. I mean, you see all the pictures of Kobe and his daughter at games, and he's so involved and invested in her future. And not just, you know, Gigi, but all of his daughters. I mean, by God, he has a 7-month-old.
I know.
And my heart goes out to Vanessa, his wife, who to lose your husband and a daughter simultaneously, I don't know how you recover from that. It's just it's unspeakable. For all of, you mentioned the Alcibellis. That's, you know, parents and their daughter to lose their lives simultaneously. That's it's so horrific. It just goes to show the fragility of life, that no one is exempt or immune, that we're all susceptible to these things. You have to really embrace life for everything it has. And I think that's the bar that Kobe set in the example, that he was relentless in everything he did. Certainly, he played with passion, but we're talking about him winning an Oscar. Clearly he was focused on such a high level to be able to, and for content that he wrote and produced himself. It's not like he just lent his name out to someone to do it. He was completely hands-on. It's a huge loss. I'm physically sick, and I've heard other NBA players and people say it feels like we've lost a close family member, and it does, because we did see Kobe grow up from the 17-year-old kid who was drafted to, you know, one of the all-time greats, and the ups and downs and everything, 5-time champion, 18-time All-Star. I mean, and just when you reduce to one name, that's icon says. You just say Kobe, and everybody knows who you're talking about.
Yeah, I want to get into that piece. We have someone standing by we want to talk to in a moment about that piece, about why this hits so close to home, even though to most of us, unlike you, who'd never met him, never interacted with him, it's still, there was a sense of loss amongst a lot of people, and that's something we want to explore. But I just also want to ask you, I'm hearing that the United Center was lit up overnight. You saw Navy Pier. You're seeing the different sports teams across Chicago reach out at this time and just pay their respects for one of the greats of the game.
And the key word is great. And I think that's what draws us to sports, is greatness. And when you get a chance to see it and witness it, we were spoiled in this town during the Jordan dynasty years. When you see that greatness, and just to get close to it, it's inspiring to us. It encourages us. It's just, we're drawn to it. And Kobe personified greatness at that level. So that's why I think so many people were drawn to him. And he just had the charisma and personality to go along with it, besides his immense talent. And he made no bones about it. His work ethic was unmatched. So all of those things, the combination of it together, just made him just a unique figure. And, I mean, just think about it. LeBron James, the night before this tragedy happened, he passes Kobe into third place on the all-time scoring list. And he wrote that message on his sneaker, Mamba for Life. And it just seems eerie now that you think about it, that not 24 hours later, Kobe is gone. And here's the next, you know, great player in Lakers lore to come follow him. It's just, I've never seen so many legends, from Kareem Abdul-Jabbar to Magic Johnson, Michael Jordan, who were just shaken to the core. I've never seen that. And we don't want to be in the, you know, creatures of the moment, but I sincerely am racking my brain to think of a time of a player. I mean, I can go back, maybe Roberto Clemente, when he was killed in a plane crash. I mean, that's another legendary player. But, I mean, a player of this ilk with this type of reach, I don't know that it's happened before to pass away in such a tragic way.
Yeah. Ryan Baker, thank you so much for taking some time for us. I know you go to bed pretty soon here. What are you, is it 7:30
now? Somewhere around there. Still got to get dinner ready for the girls and all of that. But, you know, it's been a real pleasure. I'd love to come visit with you again down the road.
I would love it. Okay, thank you, Ryan. Enjoy the rest of your day. We're going to switch gears here a little bit, talk to Elizabeth Scrivener. She's a licensed professional counselor, owner of Park Cities Counseling, parkcitiescounseling.com. And Elizabeth, we were speaking throughout the show so far today about how this tends to hit close to home, even though this is a stranger. It's not someone we knew. You just heard Ryan and me reflecting about how this, it feels sometimes like you're losing a friend. And I know you've looked into this from a counseling perspective. What is that all about?
Absolutely. It's so good to talk to you. Thank you so much. So I believe because of his celebrity status and our need to get out of our everyday circumstances, we attach to people who we can get to know by watching our favorite sport, watching our favorite movie, watching our favorite show, a way in which it is broadcast into our homes and something that gets us out of our everyday life. So those of us who didn't meet Kobe, we had a way to get outside of the humdrum, boring part, or we had an attachment to basketball or to greatness. Some people don't even like basketball, you know, and they attach to him because of his amazing talent. And so the reason when you have a loss of somebody so young, right, with so much more life to go, we feel connected. We know we don't know him. Mm-hmm. We know we don't know his life. We don't know everything.
It's such a strange thing. And I want to read a text here, 269. I think this is something, well, I relate to it, and maybe many others do. 269, the news made me think of my children and how I wanted to tell them how I feel about them. You just never know when it will be you that something happens to. I think there is sort of a reminder when it's a celebrity who is 41, who has achieved so much, who had so much more to live for and do, and was well into the way of doing it. We just mentioned the Oscar he won and the things he was doing for girls basketball. It makes us all think, you know, about every day's a gift, and it's a reminder that your days are numbered. You don't know when your day is, and that's sort of another kind of, I think, emotional response people are having to this.
It is. You hit it. The fragility of life. Life is brief. But when we go about our everyday life and you're going to work and you get your coffee and you get your food and you take care of your family and you do this and you do that, we start to think, okay, well, if I set my alarm and then I work out, or I set my alarm and then I go to work, like you're like, I feel in control. I think I'm in control. And this is just a reminder, a huge, yes, gut-wrenching reminder. We are not promised. We're not in control. We are not promised, you and I, after this interview.
Tomorrow.
We aren't promised the things. It's very, very brief.
Yeah, it's something to remember. Elizabeth Scrivener, I appreciate you weighing in with us. Owner of Park City's Counseling. She's a licensed professional counselor. Thank you so much, Elizabeth. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. Thank you.
Coming up here on WGN, Aldermanic Prerogative, the debate over it just got a little more interesting with one alderman who you would think would be for limiting those prerogatives, said, wait, not so fast. Plus, he's going to talk about why the plastic situation in the city restaurants, how that's going, what the plan is moving forward. We'll talk to Alderman Scott Wagasback in a moment. Live from the Skyline Studios, this is Anna DeVlantis, and thanks for joining us here on WGN. Our guest is Alderman Scott Wagasback. He is the chair of the Finance Committee for the City of Chicago City Council. That is, he's the 32nd Ward Alderman, and he has thoughts on all kinds of things. We have lots of things to ask you about, Alderman, from Opportunity Zones, the big announcement today, snow shoveling, plastic straws, and city finances. Think we can get to all that? I hope so. Let's start with the Opportunity Zones thing today. We had that piece of news today, and it's interesting that we're $20 million is going to go into creating opportunity zones, and it seems to be one of the mayor's priorities about sort of equity in the city.
Right.
How do you feel about what's happening there? It seems like a nice big announcement, something good for the city.
Well, I think it's a great investment, and when you look at where investment needs to happen in the city, it is in the neighborhoods that have been neglected for a long time. When you go up to the 32nd Ward, for instance, we have development going on full time, even when there was a downturn in the economy. And there was never really an effort to, you know, turn things back, look at other parts of the city and say, can we push developers and these companies to invest in these other neighborhoods? So I think the mayor's plan here is pretty good. It's really advocating beyond what Mayor Emanuel did there. And she's
how is it doing that? She says everyone seems to be saying that she's taking it another step farther.
Yeah. Well, before it was, if you did a development up on the north side, you could put money into the Neighborhood Opportunity Fund, and they would dole those funds out in small amounts to small businesses, which I think is a good process. But what the mayor's trying to do is look comprehensively and say, we can use the Neighborhood Opportunity Funds, but if we have these opportunity zones, if we invest TIF dollars in these areas to build up the infrastructure, but you also have to build up a customer base. And to do that, you need to bring in these other companies. You need to also bring in residential development, so mixed use, and really comprehensively look at what those areas need.
The mayor has said, I don't want every kid to have to beat the odds like me in yeah. order to have an opportunity in the city of Chicago. It's been something she said over and over again, that she's yeah. going to spread these opportunities across the city, all neighborhoods, and allow access to these kinds of things. How is this truly an opportunity for people who may be struggling in Chicago? How does this impact their lives?
Well, I think you have to create the jobs, and you have to create not just jobs downtown where we look at companies like Boeing. It's really great that they came in, McDonald's came back into the city, but those are executive type jobs. And while we need those, we need to look at the whole basket of jobs out there so that people have basic skills or intermediate skills are getting those jobs as well. And I think these opportunity zones kind of provide that by getting these other companies to invest there.
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff, because I guess it sort of becomes a win-win, doesn't it? The developers yeah. like it because they get to put money in, and then there's sort of the federal component that new dollars yep. come here. Is that the piece of it that we like?
Well, hopefully there's dollars coming from the federal government. maybe more in
go
the
check
future.
On that just to make sure that's still happening.
I think she's working with the state too, with our state legislators, making sure that they're involved in some of the process, but also the governor and his DECO people to make sure we're focusing state efforts in the city there as well.
Okay. Now, I have to move on and talk about the aldermanic prerogative. Been such yeah. an issue, right? Okay. Now, the mayor also ran on limiting aldermanic prerogative. Aldermen, you are one of them, alderwomen. Not all of you guys were happy about it. You seem to be one who you were initially for it. Where'd you stand in the beginning on this one?
Well, I use aldermanic prerogative in my ward, mm-hmm. I think very effectively, since I was elected in 2007, because zoning and development was the biggest issue then. It was rampant, out of control. We were able to come in and put some parameters in place, some guidelines that focus developers on transparency issues, uniformity. What I think about it is that it's a very difficult issue because it's not written in an ordinance. Aldermanic prerogative is just this practice that's out there. So I think a lot of aldermen, just like the Plan Commission did on Friday, I'm on the Plan Commission, and we talked about the changes that we're going to make there, which is everybody using the same uniform type of development meeting for the community, working with the community in the exact same way, having the same type of transparency on every deal so that you don't get deals like, say, the Lincoln Yards project, which was not very transparent at all. In some ways, it wasn't uniform in the way things were run. So I think what we're looking for is the mayor to put some rules in place, as she's done on the Plan Commission, to really rein that in a little.
Bill, I'm happy you explained that a little more, because the headlines about you on this were that you were urging the mayor to sort of halt this plan to go forward with aldermanic prerogative. So you're basically saying the way it was reading is that you didn't want her to do that, but now it sounds more as if you want the right parameters around this kind of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, right?
That article, I know which article you're referring to, the Sun Times. I think it was taken really out of context, and the way it was kind of stitched together. But we had a lengthy conversation about this, and we're going to continue to have it. But I'm all about having the transparency that's needed out there, and I think the mayor is too. And aldermen are going to come to the table and say, you know what, we do need to make things fair for people across the board, for every community. And I think that's what the mayor's working toward. But the way that story kind of came out, I think it really maybe pushed some buttons with the mayor that maybe in the wrong way. But I feel strongly about this issue, and I think there's a lot of aldermen who do as well.
Well, I think there's a lot of people and citizens who do as well, because I think yeah. that aldermanic prerogative, if you look at the history and you look at federal involvement in indictments of our aldermen over the years, and there have been a few of them. I think you've kept track of a few, maybe, and there are a couple.
My predecessor, that's...
Absolutely.
And very specifically on
Alderman
that issue.
Burke.
Yeah, I mean, with the Burger King, that was not aldermanic prerogative. It was basically stepping beyond what his written... duty or not duty was, but what he was allowed to do by code. So that wasn't even aldermanic prerogative. It was just a perception that he gave to those guys and then hoodwinked them. So that led to the indictment on that and several other issues. But I thought
he was trying to get a curb cut or something, or
yeah,
some driveways for the Burger King, and that was part central to the federal indictment.
And not to get in the weeds, but aldermen have the authority to approve alley access letters, but not so much driveways as he was doing there. And so he didn't really have that authority. But that's what they're moving forward on.
But aldermen do have a lot of authority over and say over what happens. Like, give us, for people who don't know, give us a number of those things that maybe...
We sign off on signs for businesses. An alderman can appropriately or inappropriately hold up a sign for a business. We try to sign off on those as fast as they come in, unless it's, you know, like a LED board that somebody tries to slip in, then we put a halt to it in front of somebody's house. But the mayor did a good job when they came in on some of these aldermanic prerogative issues, and they gave us a list of about 30 things and said, here's the areas that we want to cut back on. They're already executive type actions, and we're going to make them we're going to codify them so that they actually stay there and that the departments get the job done and it doesn't go to the aldermen.
So the pushback you hear is aldermen saying, we know what's best for our ward. Yeah. We have the best relationships with the businesses and the people who live in our ward. We have that face-to-face communication. We should be making those really granular decisions about what's happening in our community. And then also you hear, would a governing board at City Hall or some kind of zoning committee, if it's just take zoning piece out of it, be more fair and uncorruptible?
Well, I think the other aspect of it is, too, is the Department of Planning and Development, a lot of these guys do a good job. They do come to our meetings, but they're so stretched thin, they wouldn't be able to handle every deal that's out there. And our community groups, like, for instance, Bucktown Community Organization, Wrightwood Neighbors, Roscoe Village Neighbors. They have committees that deal with this stuff day in and day out, and we want them to have the input. We want them to have community involvement. And so that works out best for us. And as long as they are always able to be at the table and provide expertise, then I think it should stay that way.
Our guest is Alderman Scott Wagasback. He is the chair of the Finance Committee. He's the 32nd Ward Alderman, and he's also the guy who said, let's try to limit our plastics, okay, restaurant owners? And I think you probably heard a thing or two from the restaurant owners that you can tell us about. So we'll hear that, and we also want to find out about the city budget, because I think there was some positive news I saw there, too. So we'll talk with that with Alderman Wagasback coming up here on WGN. Stay with us. Alderman Scott Wagasback has stepped into the studio here. He's been with us here on WGN Radio this afternoon, and we certainly appreciate it because there are so many things affecting the city that he is front and center in dealing with, including city finances. We're going to get to that in a moment. I want to ask you, though, Alderman Wagasback, about the push for affordable housing. It's making a lot of headlines, but there seems to be this sort of balancing act between providing affordable housing, and then you saw the developers get together and push back and say, hey, we can put our money in Arizona, in Texas, in Florida. We can build buildings anywhere. Why choose Chicago if there's going to be this constant push to take 20% and bring our margins down to single digits? Are you sympathetic to that concern at all? Do you feel that these things can exist hand in hand?
Well, I think the 20% exists now, but a developer can take 10% out and say, I'm going to build in some other area, put it into the low-income housing trust fund. So they might build 10% on site, they might build zero, and then put the money into that account to be used for other areas. And I think they'd like to keep it that way. But there's also a need for affordable housing throughout the city of different levels. And I think what the mayor is trying to do is look at the different ways the housing department and Department of Planning and Development can create these new developments throughout the city while making sure that we provide affordable housing. So there are some groups out there that are pushing 30% up to 50% in terms of every deal that goes through.
Are you on board with that?
No, because that, just as you said, every developer would look at that and say, why would I do those kind of deals? I mean, there might be a couple of organizations that could do it together, but it would require a lot of city funding through either a TIF or including state housing development funds and maybe historic tax credits if you're lucky enough to have an older building. But the way that some of these ordinances are written right now, I think it would force a lot of developers out of the city. And so, you know, they just look at the bottom line on some of these deals and they would walk.
Mm-hmm. We just had someone from the State Street Redevelopment Plan on the show, and they were talking about how they envisioned that some of the storefronts and maybe up above space could one day be residential.
Yeah.
It would require zoning changes. It would require reimagining that whole corridor, which they're in the process of doing.
Yeah.
But that could potentially be something that allows maybe rents to come down a little bit, maybe open up more housing closer in, which is what a lot of people are looking for.
And that's a good way to do it. And we try to, some of the things we do in our ward is try to preserve a lot of the older buildings. You allow people to build the new stuff, but if you can preserve older buildings, it keeps the cost down as well. And some of the zoning changes do allow for residential above some of these business districts that never had people there before. So it also allows them to frequent the small businesses that are there, or the businesses in the neighborhood, which you need as well. So you do need population. You do need a complete strata of affordability. I think what the mayor's trying to work toward with a new commissioner of planning and the new commissioner of housing is to create a good balance there.
How's snow removal going in your ward? Are people getting fined? Are they complaining about the sidewalks not shoveled? There's a lot of icy sidewalks around. I have noticed these, not necessarily in your ward, but throughout the city.
Well, there are, and I think we call them in, but we push it out there quite a bit. We try to warn people about the tow zones too. You know,
the overnight parking ban,
which needs to be revamped.
How would you revamp that? I haven't.
Other cities like, I think, Minneapolis and some of the ones further north that have a lot more snow, they do things like you can park on one side of the street, but you have to clear the other and then switch later in the day or the next day.
So, why is parking banned even when no snow is present?
Essentially, that has, from my understanding, it's an emergency route, so they want to keep these routes clear. And you're talking about... I think a dozen or more major routes in the city. So we just have to look, because I think we're obviously look at WGN. I think most of the forecasters are pretty well on. You know, they know.
They do. There's a bit of warning, I think. Tom Skilling, just watch
Tom
him.
Skilling.
He's got you covered,
yeah.
And you'll know. I'm sure everyone already consults with him from the city anyway, because
OEMC
knows.
OEMC probably watches
they do.
Watches him.
I'm sure they do.
NOAA.
I would, if I were them.
Yep.
So you have a little warning, and you have that kind of thing. But are they giving more tickets for people who don't shovel? Is that happening?
I think so, but I'm not sure how many they've produced. I really don't know. But we try to warn people ahead and you know, kind of push that out there all the time. Be a friendly neighbor in Chicago.
Okay, so you took over the finance committee.
Yes.
And I heard things were a little bit of a mess. You don't have to confirm that, but that's what I've heard. That's what I read. And the mayor actually came out and said, I mean, when she ran, she thought there was closer to $500 million budget hole, something that needed to be plugged for which there were no funds available. It turned out to be closer to what, a billion?
838, yeah.
Okay, 838, which was then...
$838 million,
which was able to be plugged through a number of measures. I guess Springfield piece of it is still to be determined, but a lot of the other piece of that
was figured out. There was a lot of structural change in each one of these, in departments, in the financing, and Jenny Bennett, her CFO and the budget director, did a great job of bringing these issues to the table and looking at where we could make cuts, where we could find other ways to bring new revenue in. And they've done a great job on the city finances. They were just in on the East Coast. They were here in Chicago. They did basically a finance tour and talked about the structural changes that they're doing this year, the ones that they're going to do next year. And the rating agencies came back and said, look, we approve of this method of really tackling some of the issues that the former mayors would never do.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a very small example of just that policy approach is when we took over the finance committee, we had to revamp that as well. The mayor came in and said, I'd like to see a reduced budget. We went, I think it was $2.1 million on the staffing budget down to $570 or less than that, actually. We're working with a lot less and doing a lot more. But we're also revamping the way that deals were made so that there's more openness and transparency. That's what the mayor is doing on the finance team as well.
It seems across the board she's doing that.
Yeah, and so what happened the other day, they got a $100 million bump on the savings that they thought they were going to have, which was around $220 million. So I think it'll be a lot higher, the money that we'll be able to put back into the budget.
Yeah, that was a story about how there's a City Hall gets a $100 million gift from Wall Street, meaning that they had thought that the debt here was a little more risky and that the investor confidence was strong enough that it was able to improve the city's credit profile. How about that?
And I think it's great. There's two things there. Again, it's the work that the CFO and the budget staff are doing and the mayor, but it's also, while some of the developers are looking to other cities, the rating agencies look here and the investment firms look here and say, hey, Chicago did a great job, but we also want to invest in muni bonds because what they're seeing worldwide is, you know, a little pushback.
Scary stuff.
Yeah, so they're looking back to muni bonds as a very successful way to make a little profit.
Also cited though what were the steps the administration is taking in order to be more fiscally sound, and that's a piece of your job. How's that going?
I think it's going very well. The mayor has a laundry list. I mean, it's very extensive of all the financial things that they have to change. We have a lot of sister agencies that they eventually want to, you know, put in the right direction as well with the finances. So it's a comprehensive outlook that she's taking. The staff that she has, Susie Parker, the budget director, both her and Jenny Wang worked in other parts of the city, and they saw what was going on. So they're bringing that expertise here to say, here's the things we would have changed in prior administrations, and now we're going to do it.
What about workman's comp? Is that, I know you had a role in sort of looking at that. It seemed that there are a number of stories about some abuse potential there and abuse that had happened over time. It was a $100 million
plus
workman's comp program.
Yep.
That's a huge number.
Very closed door. There were audits done, but those audits didn't show how it was really performing and who was doing what. That was all closed behind closed doors. And, you know, when the mayor came in, that was a commitment that she made. And that was all coming out of the Finance Committee. It was very strictly run out of there. And we have since moved it to back to the executive, where almost every city in the United States keeps it or houses it. And audits were done, initial audits, more audits are going to be done, and that hopefully that program will be reduced in terms of cost.
Going forward, then, should we feel more comfortable about the tax situation in Chicago?
Well, I think we still have to look for new revenues. We have pension obligations that are not going away, and we're obligated to pay those. We have to make sure that we fulfill those obligations to city workers. However, with the structural changes and a lot more to come, these are issues of almost corruption in the way we were running things that were never tackled for decades. And so I'm glad to see the mayor come in and do some of the things we've been asking for since I've been an alderman. And I think when you look at those rating agencies and the way they rate the city, look, $100 million bump for the city is incredible. And if you can get the basis points back up to where we want them, and they see a confident outlook for the way we run the city,
that's great for us.
Things will change in a positive direction.
Okay. So yeah, the mayor said that she doesn't want to hurt people who can least afford it, but she also doesn't want to drive businesses out of here either, which is sometimes a necessary side effect.
Well, and there has to be balances in the way we do things.
Yeah. And it sounds like you're trying to work that out. Okay. Are you working out the whole plastic limits? Because I know you might have by now heard from several restaurant owners when you decided that the foam food containers weren't a good idea. We want to get rid of those in a year. You got to ask if you want a plastic straw or utensils. Did I get that right? What else? Well, tell me about it.
So basically, we're trying to reduce the city's waste and protecting public health. And we know that our river and the Great Lakes are just filling up with tons and tons of plastic waste. That's where the stuff ends up. It's either blowing out of landfills or it's filling up landfills. China won't take our stuff anymore. Malaysia and the other Asian states, they're refusing our plastics. So we need to figure out how to reduce stuff by taking it out of the stream. It's ending up in a lot of these plastics break down and they end up in our water. And they're ending up in the fish that we're eating out of the lakes.
There was a story about how 22 million pounds were found, are estimated to be going into Lake Michigan every year. 22 million pounds of plastic.
It is astronomical numbers that then get churned up and shredded, and we're drinking it. And it's not just Chicago, but if you look at the 100-plus municipalities that get our water, you know,
rivers,
out to Joliet, everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's really affecting the health of our children. So, in reality, you know, we've been talking about this issue and prodding and pushing in the city council here and there, but it was really a bunch of kids who came to us and said, hey, can we do this ordinance too?
Kids came to you.
Yeah, from Ray School in Hyde Park, and we worked with them and a lot of allies to put this together. Now, there's going to be negotiations. There's got to be a balance there as well. A lot of small businesses are already doing this stuff. If you look in Europe, if you look in Asia, they're already doing it. They're already saying you have to ask for a straw, chopsticks, places I've been, cups, all those kind of things. You have to really ask for it, pay for it, or they don't offer it at all. And there's a lot of shops here in Chicago that already do it. Go to your favorite coffee shop, and they're not using a lot of plastics. So it's a good approach. It's about our kids' health and future generations, and I really want to push it.
All right. Well, Alderman Scott Wagsback, I hope you will come back and let us know how things are going. Thanks for updating us on so many issues regarding
Thank you,
the
Anna.
City. Good to see you.
Appreciate you having me.
The news is coming up next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. We'll have that and much more here on WGN. It's Money Monday, and we're answering your money questions coming up at 2 o'clock. But also, did you see the exchange between that Iowa dad and Senator Warren? It's made this just shown how the debate over loan forgiveness and college tuition and that whole really difficult conversation, it just shows you how many people are at odds over what the right answer is, what the solution is. We'll play some of that. We'll also hear from Ray Kaplan and David Hochberg and answer your money questions. Coming up here on WGN, that is all coming up after the news from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Steve Bertrand standing by with that. It's 2 o'clock. It's Monday, 2:05, really. And our guests, Ray Kaplan of the Kaplan Law Firm, David Hochberg of Team Hochberg. You know them. They solve a lot of your money problems, and they save a lot of people a lot of money. Guys, I'm happy you're here because we're going to get to questions and texts, and people have financial questions of any sort that I know you can answer. But I have a couple big picture things first, okay? So FICO scores, they're changing the way those are being calculated. We'll get to that. And then there's some big numbers out on mortgage data and refinancing. We'll get to that. But first, did you see this exchange in Iowa between Senator Elizabeth Warren.
Outstanding.
Yep. And an Iowa dad. It basically kind of put a spotlight on the complexities of moving forward with loan forgiveness. Yep. Let's play some of it. I want to get your takes in a second here. Here it is if you did not hear that exchange.
My daughter's getting out of school. I saved all my money. She doesn't have any student loan. So you're going to pay for people who didn't save any money, and those of us who did the right thing, it's free. Of course we did. My buddy had fun, bought a car, went on vacations. I saved my money. He made more than I did. But I worked a double shift, worked extra. My daughter works, she is 10. So you're laughing. Yeah, that's exactly what you're doing. We did the right thing, and it's true.
I appreciate that.
And that was it. So basically, difficult to hear there, but let me recap it for you. He approaches Senator Warren and says, you know, I worked a double shift. I saved money for my daughter's college. But you're going to do the loan forgiveness. And guys like me, people like me who tried to do the right thing and worked our butts off doing it, we get screwed.
Right. How is that fair? Exactly. And I think he voiced the sentiment of a lot of people out there. I've talked to a lot of people who just don't feel that it's fair that they paid off their student loans, and now we have a whole generation of people who are saying that we're not even saying that they're unable to pay their student loans. It's just, shouldn't we just forgive the student loans because it's a big problem and some people are in default? And the other thing that is not really being explored by the media is that the way the current statute, the law that already applies to federal student loans, is there. It's very forgiving, and if you plan things the right way, you can be like two of my clients where they ended up taking out about $240,000 in Parent PLUS loans to finance their kids' educations, and because they're close to retirement, they're going to wind up paying over 25 years $1,000 back on a $240,000 loan. Hmm. So there are already, now that's not going to work for everybody, but it gives you an idea that the statute already allows you to pay 10% of your discretionary income and get the rest wiped out. So you don't have to, they don't have to forgive all of these loans, because we can structure loans so that you pay back something, but you know what you're supposed
what
to
you
under the current law. Yeah.
David? I think that father hit it on the head, not only for the people that saved money and put money aside. Three girls were born, I started saving for college. Very fortunate I could do that. A lot of people can't do it. I get it. A lot of people don't have, you know, $500 in their savings account. I get it. Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm just very fortunate I was able to do that. I think the father in Iowa that addressed Senator Warren the way that he did not only speaks for a lot of folks out there, a lot of your listeners that are, you know, feel the same way, but what about the men and women who didn't go to college?
Correct.
Okay, and mm-hmm. what am I, you know, my problem with this whole student loan forgiveness is, what am I going to get if I didn't go to college, the men and women out there that went from high school into the working, you know, full workforce, became the carpenters, became the plumbers. What am I going to get? Okay,
well, that's right. And there was a study of Warren's proposal. I read her actual proposal, and it really benefits the top tier of income. People who with the top tier income levels, and people on the bottom tier get very little of the benefit. So basically, you're rewarding people who have gone to college and who do much better in our economy anyway than you are. So, and then the people who didn't go to college and might not be faring as well in our economy get no relief. And
I don't quite understand that, because that's contrary to what she says and how she sells that plan, which doesn't surprise me about a politician to do that. It just I'm just trying to understand the math that you've actually done, because you're a math person and you've looked in detail at her plan.
Right, because we're talking about college grads with $50,000 of federal student loans or more, and those people are generally making more money than people who did not go to college. And those are the people who are going to get 60 or 70% of the benefit of her proposal. So then the people at the bottom who didn't go to college or maybe dropped out of college and who have less than, so you're not going to have $50,000 in loans if you dropped out of school, most likely they're not going to get any benefit.
Or if you didn't go to school at all. Okay, if you didn't go to school at all.
Right?
Here, number one, why is school so expensive to begin with?
That's an excellent question. That's the piece I think needs to be looked at.
The loans are underwritten by the federal government.
Thank
There's
you.
No incentive to have rational-based loans that make sense for what you're going to school for, because they just keep raising the tuition and they build these huge student loan centers and unions and everything, and the schools have huge billion-dollar endowments.
Yeah, so that whole math doesn't make sense to me. 847, how about not forgiving the loan entirely, just stop charging interest on the loan? Because I know several people say, I'm just going to pay the interest until I die, because my salary currently does not support the amount of loans I have and the expense that I incurred by going to college.
Right. If you do it the right way, and if we plan and give you a roadmap and a strategy to finance your kids' education, you don't even have to worry about the interest, because you're not going to pay it.
Yeah, we have another person who says, I'm one of those parents. It makes me so angry.
Thank you.
Also, exactly what you're talking about, David, that people will relate to and say, okay, if this is supposed to be the grand fair plan to make things easy for people, other people who did save, and not just parents who save, kids sometimes work extra jobs and try to save for their education. So when you graduate and you work through school, that you wouldn't have a loan forgiveness either.
Right. Well, apply the same logic to a proposal to forgive credit card debt. Or past due taxes. Would that be perceived as fair for people who had their wages garnished and paid off their credit cards or paid off their taxes? Right. Is that fair then to just forgive a whole bunch of people who, for whatever reason, basically because there's pandering going on? That really is what it comes down to.
I just wonder, though, the sustainability of the whole college process right now. I mean,
it's
it isn't sustainable at these current rates. The salaries don't support the debt. And you see kids becoming adults and then not foregoing buying a house, foregoing having children, foregoing life, because they're saddled with this crazy, crushing debt.
We did this in 07, 08 with, it's called the housing collapse. Okay, there was a whole huge flow of money coming into the system, 07, 08. Then what happened, right? Values of property went up. People took money out of their houses. Yes, I helped a lot of listeners take money out of their houses. Yes, I helped people get loans. You know, but the bottom line is that when the money slowed down, values came down, things got back into some type of normality. Okay, that hasn't stopped with the student loan debt, right? Values came down, market correction. Some people lost their homes. Some people, you know, some listeners got their loans modified. Some listeners lost their homes. Some listeners filed bankruptcy to start over. So, and that was 10, 11, 12, 13 years ago.
Exactly.
And now we're out of it.
Why
Nothing's
is it
changed
only,
with the student loans,
right,
though.
Why is it the only industry that's not regulated? I mean, as bankruptcy attorneys are only allowed to charge a certain amount in terms of attorney's fees. There are a lot of, most industries are heavily regulated, but in terms of what colleges can charge for tuition, it's not regulated.
708, Anna, look at the salary pensions of the professors and administrators. Federal subsidy of loans always raises prices. That's why college is so high. And I paid for my son's education, $75,000. I went to Illinois State in the 70s for $1,300 a year. Yep. Mm-hmm. I mean, you think about the cost of education rising nowhere near the way when you look at wages are rising. It doesn't equate.
In 2004, the national student loan debt was about $224 billion. Today, it's $1.6 trillion. There's a big problem there when it rises by that much.
University of Illinois, $3.6 billion in endowment. The same week that they increased tuition on the 50-some thousand students down at Champaign. They also increased the salary of the president. God bless the president, right? If he wants to make $1 million, $2 million being a president of a university, no problem. Don't give the guy, it's just bad visual there. Give the guy a bump in salary the same time that you're increasing it on the backs of the students while you're sitting with $3.64 billion right. with a B, mm-hmm. dollars of endowment. That's a lot of money.
All right, we're going to talk more math, but also answer your questions. We've got a lot of texts from people who have a number of questions, too, about their personal situation, but also the system that we're trying to sort out with politics and find the right solution so that it can be affordable and people won't be in debt for the rest of their lives.
Right, and it's not going to be an easy solution with a magic wand. We're going to forgive the debt. That's not going to solve the problem.
All right, Ray Kaplan, David Hochberg, back with them here on Money Mondays on WGN in a moment. Just a couple of texts here, guys. Ray Kaplan, David Hochberg, our guests here on Money Mondays. We have people talking about the whole failing system of universities. The big salaries at universities, this is Nancy, goes to the top, not to the support staff. It's hard to make ends meet right now on the salary I make as an executive assistant. She names the university frustrating.
The thing is that I think that the federal government is not afraid to mandate things, right? I think we can all agree on that. So if these universities and colleges are getting billions of dollars in federal funding from the Department of Education, why would it be crazy to suggest to them that if you have an endowment over X amount of dollars, that you have to give X amount need-based to students, and then that those funds, the students don't have to pay back. They would be essentially kind of like Perkins loans.
Right.
A grant.
Are the politicians mentioning that one?
No. Please. Nobody mentions that. And I mean, I don't think that that's a crazy idea. I mean, just kind of off the top of my head, but why not go somewhere like that? I mean, the universities have billions of dollars in endowments. You can only build so many student unions and all of that money is just sitting there. And the reason that they're able to save that money is because of the federal government underwriting all of these loans. That's why they have those endowments. So some of that money they should have to give back to students.
Something's got to change. 630, I took a huge amount out of my 401k to pay off my kids' loans so that they wouldn't be crushed by student.
I
wish you'd call. Exactly what I was thinking.
Don't do that.
So I wouldn't have to pay until retirement.
Jeez.
Stop increasing tuition rates.
Tax hit. So you take a tax hit when you do that, when you take money out of your 401k early.
Because it's not a qualified withdrawal.
Yes, exactly. And then to pay off the student loans where it honestly, because of the way the law already applies, you really didn't have to do that. So anybody out there that's considering do that, I'm not saying it is never, ever the right thing to do, but 99% of the time, it's not the right thing to do.
Okay, here's a question for both of you. And I don't even know how to make sense of this, but I know you two will be able to answer this. 847, Anna, show question. At the time our children went to college, our home was paid. We took out a new 15-year loan on our house, $200,000, with a much lower interest rate versus the parent plus loans interest. Is there any loan forgiveness for us?
Zero.
No.
That doesn't exist. No, so this is just speaks to the whole issue of juggling finances however you can.
Right.
401ks, beg, borrow, steal from other areas of your life.
This is why it's so important
to
have a strategy.
Yes.
A strategy. There's some financial planning involved. If you have kids that are even in the eighth grade or in high school, and you want to put together a roadmap and a strategy, taking all of these things into consideration so that you can completely finance your kids' education and spend as little as possible, save as much as possible, that's what we can do, and we do that every day.
And it's not only kids. If your grandkids are in seventh or eighth grade, and your kids who are, your kids, your grandkids' kids, right? You know, your kids' kids are your grandkids. So, your kids might not be listening today. But if you've got grandkids who are seventh and eighth grade or in high school or getting ready, it's a financial plan. You're talking about $200,000 per kid to go to college.
Jeez.
We all know that that's just
unbelievable,
freaking crazy.
Right.
Okay. And people don't plan that.
How do you plan when you look at what you're making? You're looking trying to make ends meet.
Because you've got an expert sitting right next to me by the name of
Ray Kaplan. I hear you. Ray Kaplan.
And honestly, it's true. If people knew how this works, nobody would be afraid of student loans or financing their kids' educations, even 3, 4, 5 kids, we can structure it and we can do it so that you're going to pay very little. It's not going to hurt. You're not going to have these $1,500 monthly payments. You'll probably pay nothing until all the kids are graduated, and then you'll pay very little.
Okay, so that nothing, that's deferment, is that right?
It's deferment. And then people always ask me, okay, but isn't interest going to accrue? And the answer is yes. Do we care? No, because you're not going to pay it.
You're not going to pay it.
You're not going to pay it.
Based upon your age, and it's based upon your income. And as you get older, the retirement income doesn't come into the calculation, correct?
Exactly.
Okay.
Right.
That's helpful.
Right. And so what'll happen is that people will go in, they'll talk to a financial aid officer who's a kid.
Doesn't
know what they're doing, and will push a Wells Fargo or a Discover loan application in front of them, and then they're stuck for a huge payment that has no flexibility. But if they had to come in to see us, we could have saved them all kinds of money.
Do student loans no longer have deferment if needed when careers change? I used that more than once when I was paying off my loans. The thought of forgiveness is infuriating to me. I paid mine, basically.
There you go.
Well, the statute was written to encourage certain things. And so what Congress had in mind was, we're going to encourage you to go into the public sector, to go work at a hospital or to work at public schools, a teacher, nurses. And so in order to do that, we know you're going to have to take out loans to go to school, but we'll help you out. You only have to pay a certain amount. So you're just paying what Congress said you should pay. You're not paying more. Right now, people are paying, overpaying, and then going into default and getting into trouble on their credit.
We have a caller on the line. She has something that she wants to weigh in on about this. Lisa, you're on WGN Radio. What do you have to say?
Hi. I was just saying, we have 3 daughters. One has already been through college. One is currently in college. We took the William D. Ford Parent Plus loan for our first one, paid over $12,000 in interest. I would love to know more about this deferred loan through your expert that's been on. So I don't know if you can say the name of her company again or her phone number, because I never got that.
Ray Kaplan?
Unfortunately.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, it's our website is financialrelief.com, or you can call us at 312-294-8989.
You got to do that again. That's way too fast.
We'll do that at the end.
Okay, go ahead.
312-294-8989.
So I wish I would have known that, although I think our income might put, you know, I don't know if our income would qualify for that. I'm not sure about the retirement age or all that, so I am going to look into that.
It will for sure.
Okay. I wish I knew that, because like I said, we paid $12,000 of interest. Now we have another one in school, and I've picked up a second part-time job. My husband makes a good income, but, you know, these kids want to go to prestigious universities, and our daughter is out of state. She's at a public school, but we're paying the out-of-state tuition, which is, you know, more than what we can handle with just my husband's salary. So she's worked all through high school. I work a couple part-time jobs.
Yep.
We're trying to make this work. But the thing that I think people, I'm all for equal opportunity for everybody, but I'm not for the student loan forgiveness that Elizabeth Warren is for, because you can find a way to be smart, be savvy, and work, and you can get a college education today for $35,000.
Less, even less.
Smart, and you go to community college, and you live at home, and you make sacrifices, and you work. If you want to go away and have the college experience, or go to a prestigious university, or choose to go out of state and pay that out-of-state tuition, you should figure out a way to pay your loans back.
Yeah. What's your name?
Lisa, we should get your information.
If we had a webinar that answered all of your questions, would that be beneficial to you and other listeners, Lisa? If we did a webinar?
Yes.
Okay. So Ray and I are going to put together a webinar, a Home Sweet Home Chicago webinar.
Great.
We're going to ask for the listeners' questions, and we're going to do a webinar, and we'll do a number of them, because we're never going to get through all the questions
at
once.
No, you won't.
All right,
but
there you go.
Please let me know.
Yeah,
we'll talk about it on the show.
Absolutely.
We're going to have you back anyway. I want to get to Brian. He's also been waiting on the line for a while here to tell us your thoughts about the conversation. I think, is it student loan related, Brian?
Yes, it is. And actually, the listener just commented, touched on most of what I wanted to say. I'm 70, and I'm finally going to retire because, you know, I lost a lot of my savings paying for 2 daughters to go through college. You know, a lot of the same things that other callers commented on. You know, my big issue, I guess, is people have steak taste and hamburger budgets. And
that's right.
People go to schools, you know, yeah, wouldn't it be nice if you could send your kids to prestigious schools? But there's not an entitlement to do that. I mean, junior college, you know, spend 2 years in junior college. Most of these kids probably don't know what they want to do for sure anyway, so why pay, you know, a four-year college? And then go to a state college.
But here's the good news. You can send your kids to prestigious colleges if you get Parent Plus loans. It really doesn't. There's a way to structure it, and you guys can give us a call, and we can walk you through it. We do it all the time. We provide a roadmap. We tell you exactly how to do this. I mean, I had that example of the parents who took out $240,000. They're going to wind up paying $1,000 over 20 years. That's it. Now, again, I know that people don't want to look like they or don't want to feel like they're taking advantage, but really we're just applying the statute as Congress meant it to apply to you so that you don't overpay.
We have just opened up a Pandora's box here. There are a number of people. I don't know if you'll have a chance to look at the text line, but I know that you're coming back very soon to talk about this issue. Ray Kaplan, David Hochberg, we've so many things we didn't get to, so when we come back, we will. Remind us, though, Ray, because we did have several requests, how to find you, and then also David Hochberg.
Sure. Our website is financialrelief.com, or give us a call at 312-294-8989.
And you can reach me at 855-56-DAVID, and on this weekend show, Amy Kite, Realtor, Gary Novell, Credit Enhancement Expert, and Will Santiago, the Garage Fix-It-Upper Guy. So listen this weekend after Lou's show at 10 until noon.
Let us know about that webinar. I'm sure listeners will be interested in that. Financialrelief.com is also where people can go for you. We had a listener ask about that, so I wanted to repeat it. That then they can get the information from there.
Yes, and there are a number of my excerpts from WGN Radio, and we talk a lot about this stuff on there too. So.
Of course, and it keeps going because there's a lot of need and a lot of people wondering what they can do. Thank you both.
Sure.
I'll see you
Thank
soon.
You.
More to come here on WGN Radio. WGN, this is Anna DeVlantis. We want to check in with a former WGN Radio co-worker of ours. Now he's big time, but he still talks to us. His name is Damati Pongo. He's here all the time. He's on the shows. He's in the hallways. So even though he now works as a correspondent and host at MTV News, he was on the Grammys, red carpet, interviewing all the stars, and he does all this really cool stuff. Isn't that right? You still talk to us, Damati. We're so happy that you do.
Former sounds so weird, man. I
know.
Still work there, honey.
Well, you're not former. You're still there. You're still here, right?
So my favorite thing, I'm still Chicago's very own.
We love that. But you're more. It seems like you're more with MTV now than us. And so I'm mad about that. But I love to see your success. And we all knew it when you were here. We're like, he'll be here for a little while. We know he'll still come back and see us. We know he'll still be working here a little. But you're like, you know, you're out there with Billie Eilish on the red carpet yesterday. I saw your Instagram and I was like, wow, look at him go.
Thank you. I don't know. You guys used to always say it. You're like, we're borrowing over to you for a little while.
He's just
so
borrowing
him. Thank you for giving me back to Hollywood. But no, I mean, the Grammys were amazing. I didn't expect, we're talking to Billie. She was so humble. You know, I asked, what is it like to be here? What do you expect? You know, the questions you ask at the red carpet. And she kept saying,
I'm
not going to win anything.
Hey, Damati, is this what you put on Instagram? Is this that interview you had on your Instagram? Yeah, I think we have
Let's check it out.
Let's check it out.
When you win this Grammy, when you take home some hardware, I'm going to speak that into existence. Where are you putting your Grammy?
If I get one, which I won't, but if I do, hopefully I do, go on my mantle.
You have 6 nominations. Your brother has 4. 1, how proud are your parents? And 2, is there any simple rivalry?
You know what? What's crazy is no. We're like, there might be deep down, probably. I don't know.
There's so much more. I wish we could play it. But you did see that, though, Damati, when she was on stage.
Yeah.
I don't know which Grammy it was she was accepting, but she just, the love she showed for her brother. I mean, the two of them. Wow. Talent.
Yeah, exactly. And then said that she wasn't going to win anything, but ended up taking 5 of 6 Grammys. Like, what? And was one of the youngest artists. You know, she won Best New Artist and Album of the Year. She won all the 4 major categories. But in recent history, only Norah Jones, Lauryn Hill, has really won Best New Artist and Album of the Year in the same year. It's not something that happens all the time.
No.
You know, she really made history and swept the Grammys. Bad Guy won Record of the Year. I mean, this is a big year for Billie Eilish and for Phineas, her brother.
Yeah, and then she set records for the youngest, right? Wasn't she the youngest, beating Taylor Swift's youngest to ever get Album of the Year? And
yes.
Record of the Year. I mean, just the way she's just arrived. Boom. And she's, what, 18? Is she 18?
18 years old. And what's so phenomenal about it to me, too, is, like, you know, it gets put in the pop category, and it is pop. But it's kind of like this affected, more emo kind of, and, you know, Bad Guy is a hit. Undoubtedly, it's a poppy song, but the album is really more of has a haunting feel to it. It's not the kind of project that you would necessarily think would, you know, affect the zeitgeist in the way that it did. Like, you would expect an album, like, you know, that was chock full of pop hits to really make a splash like this. But this is something that has some depth to it, but also is good enough to get some radio play and has people paying attention. That's what's really interesting about the Grammys this year, and even genre in general. A lot of the people nominated, it's hard to even put them in a certain genre. Like, Tyler, the Creator, won Best Rap Album for Igor, but it actually sounded kind of like an alternative pop album, if nothing else, you know? So it's just interesting watching how music is evolving and being able to talk to some of these folks in person.
Yeah, you just get up close with her. She's a rising, I mean, more than rising star. She has risen in so many ways, and you were there with all of them. Just for a second, can you step back for a second and just, do you ever think about what it is you're doing and just how cool it is?
I literally had that moment this morning, Anna. Like, so everything happened so fast, and I was trying to, you know, take it all in, but you really just want to do a good job. You want to just communicate the best way you can, and I stress myself out to see how I can make these 2-minute, 3-minute interviews worth something and not just get the same type of content every time around. And as I was going through that in my mind, I finally just realized, man, it's the being here alone is the blessing. I talked to the rapper, The Baby, and I said, what's it like to win these nominations? He said, just being here and being in a conversation is a blessing. And I feel the same way. But it was interesting because it kind of brought me down to earth when, as we're getting ready for the carpet, the cameraman is setting up, and you start hearing murmurs that Kobe Bryant had passed away.
Oh, my gosh.
And, you know, so it's like, it was just a weird roller coaster of emotions, from, you know, feeling frantic and just hoping to do a good job, to being grateful just to be in the conversation, whether we get the big stars or not, to hoping that I get some good feedback and content from artists who are still trying to process Kobe Bryant's passing. So it was just a lot going on.
How true is that? And then you think I was thinking about this because you're at the Staples Center where Kobe played for so many years, and you had this great event of entertainment and fun and just excitement that it just was suddenly weighted down by something, you know, somebody of like him and this horrible event that killed 9 people that was connected to there. We have, you know, how good did Alicia Keys do at setting that tone right off the start of the Grammys?
Yeah.
I don't know how you could have done that better, to merge those two worlds at once. We have a little bit of that. If people haven't heard it, we got a little bit here for you.
Here we are together on music's biggest night, celebrating the artists that do it best. But to be honest with you, we're all feeling crazy sadness right now. Because earlier today, Los Angeles, America, and the whole wide world lost a hero. And we're literally standing here heartbroken in the house that Kobe Bryant built.
That was the piece right there where you just thought,
that was perfect. That was perfect. The perfect, yeah, you felt the weight of it. You felt the sincerity. She was such a phenomenal host. And I love Alicia as a host in general because she creates these sincere moments that I love in the time when award shows usually opt for comedians to guide us through these things. So there's lightness, there's levity, but having a host who connects with the artist in an authentic way, the way Alicia Keys does, and connects to her emotions in a sincere way, and having her lead us through that moment to kick the night off was like, it was perfect. Mm. It was perfect.
She makes you feel like she's in your living room. You know, she just breaks right through, and it's so, and then handling what she handled with that kind of news just dropping on her and so many others at that moment. That is not easy to do. So I give her all the credit in the world. Tell us what else we might have missed. I did have to go to bed, so I did not see the last half of the Grammys. I put my little girl to bed. She was dancing around the room to all the songs, and then she was like so crazy. I'm like, okay, we got to go to bed now. And I missed a little bit of the back half. Tell us what anything else we should know, because you were there up close and personal with all the stars and able to see it all.
Yeah. Well, speaking of loss, you may have missed the tribute to Prince, which was phenomenal. Usher performed. That was a phenomenal performance. It was great to see Usher take center stage, and she hasn't missed a beat, of course. Mm-hmm. Singing in a beautiful falsetto, FKA Twigs dancing on stage. You had the tribute to Nipsey Hussle, which this was another eerie moment, because the last time I was at the Staples Center, I was covering the funeral for rapper Nipsey Hussle, who had been gunned down, and you had this tribute put together with Kirk Franklin and DJ Khaled and YG and rappers Meek Mill and Roddy Ricch. And then they have this moment at the end where, you know, they both point at the Jumbotron and you have or the screen, and you've got Nipsey's face, and then they have to add Kobe Bryant's face right there. Yeah. Powerful moment, powerful tribute to both Kobe and Prince. You may have missed Demi Lovato's return to the stage.
Oh, heard about performed. That.
Yes, since her overdose, and her song was so raw. So emotional. The lyrics in it said something like, you know, I feel silly when I sing. I feel like no one actually hears me. And, you know, if you know anything, when we report about people who struggle with addiction, a lot of times it's because they don't feel heard. Sometimes it's because of, you know, things they're struggling with personally and emotionally. And I think that she really gave voice to what it was she was experiencing personally. So that performance was amazing. It was a great night. And then Lil Nas X performed with everyone who's everyone who's ever made a remix to Hotel Road.
It's like they had revolving house or something. Then, and each time you opened up to a new room, there was a new act there from that Korean pop group, BTS. Is that who they are?
Yes.
To like Billy Ray Cyrus, who he originally cut the song with, right? And then you just had a number. Wasn't it, who else do we have out there who was with him?
You had the little boy who went viral singing in Walmart. I could not remember his name, but the kid who went viral, and the reason why I forgot his name, as I was Googling this kid to get ready for, because I wanted Entertainment Tonight to talk about the Grammys, I was Googling this kid to get ready for my next hit, Nas comes out and performs, rapper Nas, who, you know, has the namesake Lil Nas X, and Nas is a legend, one of my favorite rappers, just a pioneer in hip-hop music, who normally you wouldn't think would get on a record this poppy and commercial, comes out there and drops an amazing verse. I forgot everybody else. I forgot everything that happened prior. I was over the moon, and Nas came out. That was like that capped it off.
It was such a great night, and it's so good to hear from you, Domati. Thank you for remembering your friends here, and good luck to not that you need it, but good luck in everything you do, because you deserve it all. And we'll keep watching you, MTV. Follow you, too, because that's another way, on Twitter and Instagram. Instagram, what are you again?
DOMETI_. So just DOMETI_. You can catch some of my interviews with some of the stars I got a chance to talk to. I actually talked to Lil Nas X, too, about why people loved his album 7 so much. Yeah, it was cool. He has on a really fun outfit.
He wore everything. It was like, woo, okay. Thank you, DOMETI.
Yeah,
you're
going to put the whole thing on. Everything pink in your closet. Just wear it. Okay, cool. All right.
DOMETI Punga.
It was a good time.
It's so good to hear from you. Thank you for checking in with us, and keep checking in with us, okay?
Absolutely, I will. Thank you, Anna.
All right, thank you. Coming up, trending topics, including the speech. Another speech we want to bring you from the Grammys, and a heartfelt note to Kobe Bryant's wife has surfaced in the wake of his death, and we're going to talk about that and other trending topics at this hour here on WGN. Steve Bertrand has stepped into the studio here, so has Lauren Lapko. We're ready for trending topics. Lauren and Steve are here, and did you both watch the Grammys last night?
I watched most of it.
Yeah, I'm a good part of it, not all of it.
The part that I really loved and brought a tear to my eye, and I pretty much held off tears until this point, which was hard to do with all everything that was going on, but Camila Cabello, she sang a song mm-hmm. that was a tribute to the first man that really loved her, and it was about her dad.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man. I think everyone cried.
God. Well, then she they did the cutaways, down, and the people were crying there, and even like Gwen Stefani's crying. She's not even a dad. I mean, just let's hear a little piece of it. We have it here. You're looking at me for
I was watching with my parents, and I couldn't even look at my dad, and I heard him sniffing, because my sister did just get married in September, and you know, I'm the baby, so I'm also still here, so knowing any dad with daughters, or even any daughter out there, oh man, really eats at you.
Cue that it's up beautiful. At Father's Day, right?
I can't talk.
I don't blame you. I'm not even a dad. I'm bringing it back just as a mom. It just brings it to you. The Recording Academy tweeted at the time of that performance, this is what music is all about. And that's true, the connectivity to it, just the way she brought that emotion out, and her dad was crying too. It was
I don't know how she didn't cry.
Oh,
she held it together. Oh my gosh. I don't know, but it was beautiful.
Okay. All right. So I don't know if this is uplifting, but it is certainly also, it also grabs at your heart. Kobe Bryant wrote a touching tribute to his wife, Vanessa, just weeks before the helicopter tragedy. That just kind of surfaced this afternoon. Some reporters said, you know, hey, did you see this post where he called Vanessa his queen? On this day 20 years ago, I met my best friend, my queen, Vanessa Bryant. I decided to take her on a date to Disneyland tonight to celebrate old school style, pre-princesses, his four daughters he's talking about there. And I love you, mamacita, per siempre, forever, or for always. It's just, you know, I guess they had their first date there, and then they went back not too long ago. And this is just from a couple weeks ago.
And so he said 20 years ago?
Yeah.
So he would have been 21, yeah?
Was he 21, yeah.
So he had already been an NBA player.
A couple years. Yeah. And they were both so young, weren't they, when they got married? But there they are with all these beautiful daughters. It's just such a sad turn of events. It really is. Mm-hmm. Kobe Bryant says daughter Gianna wanted to carry on her legacy. And this is an old story from Jimmy Kimmel Live, but again, surfaced because of the tragedy that took her life. A lot of people saying, hey, this is a moment to focus on girls basketball, that's what he was doing in the second phase of his career. He was coaching women. His daughter wanted to be young women. She wanted to be in the WNBA one day. All likelihood, she probably had a good chance at that, right? Mm,
absolutely. I read a really sad perspective, someone talking about their relationship and how close they were, and how sometimes fate or God, however you want to look at it, works in funny ways, that they cared about each other so much that, of course, they had to go together. Of course, like, I'm joking. I'm just thinking about it because that was such a sad perspective.
I'm never coming back in here again.
Sorry, Steve. There's some other stuff here we're going to get to. I promise. But yeah, he also said he traveled by helicopter because it gave him more family time. Because the LA traffic was
a
problem.
We're going to find, or maybe we won't find out, but there clearly was a push to make this flight happen, because the police departments in the area had grounded their own copters because of the weather. So, you know, I don't know. It doesn't matter, but
no,
we will maybe one day find out the story about why this copter took off.
And there's an Illinois connection to that helicopter.
Yeah. It was an Illinois helicopter. Bruce Rauner sold it off, I think, in 2015.
So I think it used to transport celebrities, VIPs, even the governor.
The governor, probably. Sure, the governor had a helicopter, but he stopped using it, so they sold it.
Yeah. Well, the Washington Post, did you see, they suspended a reporter who tweeted out right away, immediately after the news of the helicopter crash broke, that talked about the accuser's story, tweeted out a link to the disturbing rape case from 2003, and he was suspended over that. I guess
it's
they thought
an insensitive time to bring that up.
Right.
I don't agree with that, though. What do you think of that?
I don't think suspension was the right way to deal with that. He was, you know, poor taste. Yeah, let people to judge that. Let people say, hey, you know, that's not right. Don't mention that. Now we know that's part of him, his legacy, what happened.
Right.
We can't erase that. We shouldn't.
Christine Brennan, the great reporter for, I think, Washington Post, but she works for CNN as well. She was on right away and saying, you know, we can't gloss over this. This happened, too. I mean, if you're retweeting or tweeting out something that's vetted and true, I don't, just because it might be unpopular with your readers, I don't know. I don't like that idea.
Yeah, I'm not crazy about the idea either. A political reporter on administrative leave over those tweets. So I don't know if they're rethinking that, because I think many others in the journalism community, at least, have pushed back and said, we don't like that either. So you heard Alicia Keys earlier. I thought she just, again, struck the right tone and a difficult night. So
perfect,
I mean,
host,
right? I mean,
really,
just
because it wasn't
incredible.
About her at all.
No,
right? I mean, a lot of the hosts, they try to make it about them, or right. I mean, which is what they're supposed to do, because that's why they're chosen, because they're funny or whatever. But yeah, she just kind of welcomed people into her house,
and she even made a song that was funny. You know, she wasn't trying too hard to be funny; she just was, and she showed off her talents. And she was very sensitive to all the issues going on as well. So I don't know how you make her performance any better.
No, I don't either. I thought she was the perfect host. And who knew that those events would hit the Staples Center where Kobe played and bring that whole piece of it really close to home. Yeah. That was an incredible balancing act to strike. But I felt she did it so, so well. 847, Anna, the rape allegation against Kobe Bryant should get equal time in the reporting about his death in addition to all the accolades. Maybe that's fair now. I think right when the news was breaking, I think a lot of people thought, well, I don't know if that's the right time. But again, suspension seems a little too far.
What was the resolution? The charges were dropped?
The charges were dropped. It was settled out of court. He gave a huge public apology that seemed very authentic.
Right.
And again, looking at how he kind of turned his life around, that's why I understand, you know, not really the right time. Of course, bring it up. You have to bring it up.
Yeah.
But while you're kind of maybe talking about his life, that's when you bring it up. Don't just make it a whole thing about that.
This is it. Right. This is the whole thing. Loud nails were the top trend of the 2020 Grammy. Did you see the nails on Billie Eilish?
Oh, my gosh.
They were like 7 feet long, and they were green and sparkly.
I would have had like three fallen off already by her performance. I don't know how they keep them on.
And then finally, Bears are down, but the ticket prices are going up. So there you go. You've got an increase of 3.9% non-club level tickets.
Another
going up
not
an
to
average
go.
4.3%. Yeah. So you got that going for you.
You know, there's talk, and I don't have it in front of me, but it looked like the Twitter accounts of several NFL teams were hacked.
Yeah, got hacked yesterday. Yeah.
Was it yesterday?
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to dig into that in a second, hopefully, with Rokan, because he's coming up top of the hour for his show. That's going to do it for Trending Topics. More ahead here on WGN Radio.